That's the one. Right. Hey, everyone. My name is Matt Tetlow. I'm just going to talk about the SUSAT QB50 mission. So a bit of a mission outline. An outline of the presentation, that is. I'm going to talk a little bit about the mission, then talk about the systems engineering that we did to start off with, a bit about the configuration design, and then testing, and then where we are at the moment. So this was a collaborative project between the two universities and Innovor Technologies. So they basically provided the technical work. Vitec, ESA10, and were providers of software, and then some funding from the government and the Sir Ross and Sir Keith Smith Fund. So basically the mission was to fly two payloads. The first was the QB50 INMS, or ion neutral mass spectrometer, and that's essentially measuring the density of those constituents and the ions in the thermosphere. And then the other one was an in-house experiment, which is called MASP, and that's just a dual frequency GPS front-end and pseudo-range calculator to work on occultation. It's an occultation experiment. So it's not the full navigation and timing solution. It's just the pseudo-range. So there was actually originally discussion about us flying NAMARU as well, but because we needed the dual frequency, we had to make our own. So to start off with, the first thing when you do any mission, you've got to make sure that the client gets what the client wants. So the first thing we started with was looking at how do we define the specification for this. So looking at some use cases and the operator needs to try and define a source requirement set. And then from that, we built a model-based systems engineering model in software called CORE from Vitec in the US. And essentially you start with your requirements, or you define your requirements, and then you work out what behaviors or functions the system needs to perform in order to satisfy the requirements. And then you allocate, make sure that the functions are being performed by something. So this is kind of the hardware, the physical layer. So what does it need to do? These are all verbs. What things are doing it? And then get a verification system going so that you can verify that the hardware is performing what it's supposed to do. It achieves the functions that it's supposed to achieve. And then also it gets... and in doing so meets the requirements. So this is just an example of the functional behavior. So you can look, the white boxes are essentially functions or verbs. So those functions are then all allocated into to the hardware layer. So these are all actual physical pieces of hardware that perform the functions that you identify need to be performed. So it's an awful lot of overhead to go about modeling the whole system. But one advantage that it provides is you have full traceability. You have a requirement, and then you can work out it's the basis of what function, what piece of hardware is performing it, and then go up and have a look at, from a verification point of view, what things are you doing to verify that function, that the functions are being performed and that meets the requirement. So this is really quite important because in the QB50 mission, from the time that I was involved, there were 25 changes to the requirements. This was after the critical design review. So... that's preliminary design review. So in each case, we would go back to the model and look at the requirement that was changed and work out how it would flow on to the other subsystems in the satellite. And it was a very useful tool to know where we were going and what impact the various changes to the requirements had on our design. All right, now a bit about the satellite itself. So in order to manage the risk, some subsystems were bought commercial off the shelf. So we figured that the high-risk systems were the power systems and the onboard computer and then the primary navigation GPS. So remember, we do have a secondary GPS, but we didn't want to rely on that for our primary navigation. Then we have solar panels with embedded magnetor because we're also off the shelf. And in-house developed, we went for the structure, and that's just because the structure is a relatively easy system to develop. Attitude determination control, that was kind of our strong suit. The communications was UniSA ITR's area of expertise, and then the other one was the MASP experiment, which I discussed before. So that just sort of splits up what we bought and what we made ourselves. So we kind of took a fairly high-risk approach. We kind of didn't want to, you could do a lot lower risk by buying the systems off the shelf and putting them together, but I guess we just wanted to see how far down we could go. So this is the structure. There's not really much to talk about. It's just aluminium 6061, just a ribbon frame structure. And there's obviously did FEA analysis and that kind of thing to make sure it was going to stand up. The attitude determination control, So originally, our requirements were to survive from a tip-off rate of 90 degrees a second within 2 days and maintain an attitude of plus or minus 2 degrees. And in brackets, you can see originally the requirement was 10 degrees a second and then it jumped to 90, which is significant. And then the maintain attitude of 2 degrees, all of a sudden it just disappeared from the requirements, so it was no longer needed, which was interesting. But because we'd sort of decided to develop an attitude control system, we stuck with this. So the control strategy is we have two modes. We have a detumble mode, where we use a magnetometer to estimate the vector of the magnetic field, and then we use the gyro to predict where it's going to move. And that you need that in order to meet the 90 degree per second tip-off rate, because you can't actuate with magnet torquers while you're reading with a magnetometer, because surprise, surprise, the magnetometer reads what your magnet torquers are putting in. Well, very much along the lines of that. So we have a slightly different, so the standard B-dot controller is what they use for detumble, and we have a slight augmentation on that. And then we have a fine-pointing control system. And that's based on a couple of layers. So first of all, we have an orbit determination. So we have a GPS, but we can't run the GPS all the time because it uses too much power. So we use a GPS, and we have a filter that takes the GPS measurements and then converts that into orbital elements. And again, each GPS measurement gives you a different set of orbital elements because the orbit, there's so many perturbations in an orbit, right? So you actually have to average all the measurements you take from the GPS. So we stage, turn the GPS on, wait for a period of, take a measurement, then wait for a period of time, and then take another measurement. And we take that out of phase with the orbit. So eventually, after a couple of days, you basically just keep on filling in the gaps between the previous measurements that you took in the orbit. We then predict that measurement forward using a SGP4, and that gives us any time we ask, our satellite knows exactly where it is. So based on our knowledge of our current position, we can then call magnetic field models and sun sensor models on board to know where the sun should be and where the magnetic field should be pointing. Those are basically our predict states, and then we have the magnetometer and the sun sensor to measure where they actually are and then use the prediction and the measurement in an uncentered Kalman filter to give us an attitude solution. So we originally ran, and obviously, as you can see, you have the gyroscopes, which add the rotational rates, which are the derivative of the state that you're trying to estimate, which enables you to predict when the sun's not there. You only have the magnetometer. You no longer have enough information to determine what your pointing solution is because you only have two measurements. You can't determine how you're rolling around the magnetic field vector. You can only work out if it's, up and down. So we ran this and we found that overnight, when we were in eclipse, we moved out of the 2 degree range of accuracy. So our attitude prediction moved into an error greater than 2 degrees, and that's because the gyroscopes weren't good enough to predict the rate information as we were in eclipse. So we added an ADIR sensor, and that basically is an infrared sensor that looks forward and works out where the horizon is, and then from that you can work out the vector to the center of the Earth. As I said, that all then gets pointed together in an uncentered Kalman filter, and then that estimates our attitude, and then we use a pointing controller, which is just a PD controller, and we have 3-axis magnet torquers, and then we have a reaction momentum wheel. So it's basically got a positive bias that runs at a couple of thousand RPM to give us momentum stiffness in the roll and yaw axes, and then by adjusting its speed, we can change the pitch of the spacecraft. So what did we make on our own? So we bought the solar panels with embedded magnet torquers, so the magnet torquer actuators were off the shelf. In-house, we developed the attitude algorithm, the uncentered Kalman filter, and also all the orbit position determination and prediction algorithms. We built our own sun sensor, so we built all the software from the drivers, everything from the ground up. We didn't use anybody's software, any part of anybody's software. Okay, testing. We did the testing, and that all went well. The thermal vacuum testing went well. And we had a couple of issues in our first shake test. The first one is, all right, so where are we? We've done all the functional and environmental testing. We've completed the flight readiness review, and it's been submitted. And we were supposed to ship last week, but we've been delayed by VKI until mid-October, so we've got to sit on our spacecraft for another 2 weeks before we can get rid of it. I'm ready to get rid of it.